the United Nations resolution for Gaza is just another futile attempt to solve the aggression and open humanitarian access to Gaza.
It's the same old story. It's an attempt by some Western countries to cover their inactivity, cover their actual participation in the genocide by doing nothing. They sell weapons to Israel. They allow this to take place. They do not impose sanctions on Israel. They do not pursue any kind of international blockade of Israel. This is a bandage which doesn't even stop the flow of blood from the Palestinian people.
The death toll from Storm Byron in Gaza has risen to 14 as the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that severe weather is hitting displaced families hard. Among the dead are three children who succumbed to hypothermia. Gaza's media office says that homes collapsing under fierce winds and flooding have left 1.5 million displaced people in danger of drowning and structural collapses. UNRWA says families are facing the storm without proper shelter. The agency stresses much-needed supplies for more than 1 million people remain blocked by Israel outside Gaza's borders, calling the restriction a political choice. Israel's genocidal war and all-out blockade on Gaza has killed nearly 70,400 Palestinians since October 2023, most of them women and children. Muti Abu Musabbeh was with us from Deir al-Balah as a 15th damaged building collapsed on displaced Gazan civilians amid storms in the Palestinian territory. Let us hear what he had to tell us.
Well, unfortunately, the apocalyptic situation on the ground goes beyond description here, because we are talking about more layers and levels of suffering are still unfolding for the entire population of Gaza Strip. We are talking about more residential buildings that are still collapsing over the heads of the Palestinian people. The last one collapsed in Ashara refugee camp in the western side of Gaza City. We are talking about another level of the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding right now in Gaza Strip, and those semi-destroyed houses have become death traps for the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip, and thousands of the makeshift tents were ruined and destroyed and uprooted by the strong winds here in Gaza Strip, and the people now are shelterless across all areas of Gaza Strip. But unfortunately, we are talking about more horrific conditions are yet, as you know, to hit Gaza Strip over the upcoming hours. But what we need to understand and realize at this moment, that what's happening in Gaza Strip right now is nowhere close to be considered as a natural disaster on the ground. It is absolutely architected, designed, and orchestrated by the Israeli regime. This is the normal and the inevitable outcome of the ongoing policy maintained and espoused by the Israeli regime towards Gaza.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that Israel's decision to legalize 19 new settlements in the occupied West Bank marks a dangerous escalation. The legalization of the 19 settlements was announced by Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. Hamas condemned the move as part of a wider project of annexation and Judaization of occupied territories. In a press statement, Hamas said the move reflects the extremist nature of the Israeli regime, which treats Palestinian land as colonial spoils. The movement stressed that settlement expansion violates international law and the UN resolutions, warning it aims to isolate Palestinian towns and villages and push communities towards displacement. Hamas urged the international community, the United Nations and human rights organizations to take responsibility and act to stop settlement growth and hold Israeli leaders accountable. Earlier we were joined by our correspondent Indra Malahnaka Hamad for more details about Israel's legalization of new settlements in the occupied West Bank.
Unfortunately, these numbers are quite serious, as we are talking about 19 new settlements that have been reorganized or legalized in the occupied West Bank. This comes in coincidence where the Israeli regime has also announced another critical number, which is almost $1 billion U.S. dollars will be allocated to through the five coming years only towards settlement expansion and to enhance, as of course we are coding, to enhance the settlement and the settler presence inside the occupied West Bank. This means that more settlements will be expanded, new settlements will be established, roads will take over to the Palestinian land, will curve the Palestinian land, and more of the actions that we are living day by day over here in the occupied West Bank will be increasing about the cutting between the Palestinian cities and the making the Palestinians centralized more towards into the city centers and deprive the Palestinians from area C, B, and most of the occupied West Bank, as there are the natural resources, the water, the agricultural land. All of these are becoming more of a dream for the Palestinians. And
Israel has intensified its flagrant violations of the one-year-old ceasefire with Lebanon, launching a fresh barrage of airstrikes across the country's southern regions and targeting what it describes as Hezbollah training sites. According to Lebanon's state news agency, Israeli warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks on hills, valleys, and rural areas in the Jezzine and Zahrani regions. The strikes hit the outskirts of multiple towns in the southern parts of the country. The aggression marks yet another episode in Israel's persistent breaches of the ceasefire and further heightening of tensions along Lebanon's border. Local reports say the repeated raids have caused widespread fear among residents and raised concerns of a broader escalation. Lebanon's foreign minister warns that Israel is preparing an imminent large-scale attack on the country following the surge in Israeli airstrikes that have killed civilians.
Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country. Youssef Raji said Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for a large-scale military operation against Lebanon. He said Lebanon is intensifying diplomatic contacts to shield the country and its vital facilities from the potential strikes. The remarks come in the wake of a fresh round of Israeli airstrikes on Lebanese soil. On Friday, regime's warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks across the country. The regime claimed that the attacks targeted Hezbollah sites and rocket launchers. However, witnesses said the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Despite the ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon in November 2024, Israeli airstrikes have continued almost daily, with little respite. The regime also maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon. This persistent aggression has sparked international condemnation, particularly from the United Nations. A UN report published this month revealed that at least 127 Lebanese civilians, including children, have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The UN has characterized these ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. Many believe that the attacks aim at pressuring Hezbollah movement to lay down its arms and reach a new deal with the Lebanese government. However, the group has ruled out any new agreement with Israel, saying that intimidation will not change Hezbollah's stance of resistance. It says U.S. and Israel's calls for disarmament are designed to weaken Lebanon and leave it exposed to external aggression. Analysts warn that the escalating confrontation risks plunging the region into a wider conflict with devastating consequences. For now, Lebanon's leadership and resistance insist that only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war.
A recent statement by Israeli diaspora minister Amichai Shekli claiming that war with Syria is inevitable has fueled public concern across the country. With ongoing Israeli violations in the south, many Syrians say these remarks feel like a direct threat. Ali Mohammed reports from Damascus.
For many Syrians, Israel's latest remarks reinforce a belief that the threat extends far beyond Syria's borders. The statement is widely viewed as an open declaration of hostility toward the region, rather than mere political rhetoric.
This entity threatens the entire Arab world, not just Syria or Palestine. We aren't afraid, but there must be a broader popular response, especially by Arabs. Sadly, people's reactions remain slow, while some governments align with Israel.
Syrians also connect these statements to recent Israeli incursions in the south, including the attack on Beit Jinn. Many view these events as early indicators of a dangerous shift that may eventually demand decisive action.
This regime won't stop at Palestine. It wants full control of the region in order to control all the resources of its people. It has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
U.S. lawmakers in the House Oversight Committee have released new photos from Jeffrey Epstein's estate showing powerful figures entangled with the late sex trafficker. Included in the photos are U.S. President Donald Trump, former President Bill Clinton, Trump's former advisor Steve Bannon, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, and filmmaker Woody Allen. Many of these men have been previously linked to Epstein, but the newly released photos may shed further light on the extent of those relationships. Trump's ties to Epstein are well known, and a recent batch of emails released by the committee shows that Trump had spent hours with one of his most prominent accusers. Epstein emphasized that those emails that Trump knew about the girls. The Epstein files have revealed allegations of trafficking underage girls to his private island, with social ties to powerful figures, including Donald Trump. The admiral in charge of U.S. forces in the Latin America and Caribbean has been critical of U.S. strikes on alleged drug boats in the region, has retired 2 years ahead of schedule. Admiral Alvin Halsey has reportedly had disagreements with U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over operations in the region. He had earlier voiced concern about the legality of the U.S. military's lethal strikes against alleged drug trafficking boats. Since September, the U.S. has deployed more than 15,000 troops, warships, and fighter jets in the Caribbean under the pretext of fighting drug traffickers. Venezuela, however, says the military buildup is aimed at toppling the Venezuelan government to gain control of its oil resources. The strikes on boats have killed at least 87 people so far. The U.S. Congress is now scrutinizing the boat attacks, including the one that killed two survivors clinging to the wreckage of an initial strike. Ukraine says its military has attacked a major Russian oil refinery in northeast of Moscow after Kyiv said fresh Russian strikes hit port city of Odessa. The Ukrainian military's general staff said explosions erupted and a large fire flared in the targeted refinery in Yaroslav region. Media quoted industry sources as saying that the facility's primary processing unit and a loading rack there were hit, suspending the plant's output. Earlier, Ukraine said Russian airstrikes had hit two port areas in the Black Sea port of Odessa, sparking a major fire and injuring at least one person. Ukrainian officials said three Turkish-owned cargo vessels were targeted in the drone and missile attack. The 19th edition of Cinema Verite, Iran's international documentary film festival, has opened in Tehran. The week-long event has drawn some of the most prominent non-fiction filmmakers. Yusuf Shahmadi reports.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
This year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
Iran has a rich history in weaving carpets, dating back to over 2,500 years ago. Originally, Persian carpets were woven by traveling nomads to cover floors and gears, which are round dwellings that are easily packed up. Persian carpets are adored all over the world. In fact, the most expensive Persian rug ever bought was a 17th century Persian vase-style carpet, which was sold at an auction in 2013 in London for over $33 million. The legacy and tradition of carpet making still remains in Iran, with intricate designs, lavish colors, and peerless artistry.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Bazaar. This week, we will take a look at rural cooperatives in Iran while shining the spotlight on the production of traditional hand-woven carpets. We want to see how they are made and why they are so expensive. Also, we will check out how cooperatives help support this sector, which contributes millions to the economy. So, let's roll out the show.
A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost tens of thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. But rugs made in Iran's Fars province are perhaps the most traditional carpets characterized by their bold designs. So our journey took us to a cooperative in this province near the city of Shiraz in order to see the production cycle of this valuable handcraft. This cooperative is made up of a chain of related trades for weaving carpets. First, we visited a dyeing complex. This facility is a massive 22,000 square meter area dedicated to boiling, spinning, and dyeing sheep's wool. The processes are all done by hand, using natural plant-based dyes. It is probably the largest of its kind in the province and one of the oldest in this field, with over four decades of experience in traditional hand dyeing. One of the advantages of plant-based dyes is that they enrich the quality of wool over time. Plus, they are non-toxic. The facility supplies bright and elaborate yarns to another part of the cooperative, which is dedicated to weaving.
Hand woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Carpet weaving in Fars is recognized as part of the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage List. In this province, materials are distributed to small villages for women to weave in their homes or in cooperatives. And Fars province is famous for its magnificent Gapbe carpets.
This weaving facility gets its supplies and yarns from other parts of the cooperative. Here, we were able to see the process of how carpets are woven. Looms for Gapbe rugs are typically laid horizontally across the floor, making their production extremely labor-intensive. The process of weaving a Persian rug differs slightly with each variety, but generally speaking, a bed of foundation material called warp is installed into the frame. Starting at the bottom, weavers then feed wool in between the warp, tying knots on each one. A highly detailed silk rug can have around 170 knots per square centimeter. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather their materials, design, and overall size. While some varieties of Persian rugs follow design specifications, Gapbe carpets are often completely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs such as goats, trees, and dolls. This weaving facility also offers training courses for handmade traditional carpets. These establishments are particularly important for women. Much of the traditional carpets woven here are made by the dexterous hands of ladies, which also generates income for them. This cooperative is one of 1,900 cooperatives scattered around the country. Currently, there are over 100 carpet weaving complexes and over 5,000 centralized and non-centralized workshops nationwide, too. That's based on figures from the National Carpet Center.
Women in rural areas play a key role in the agriculture sector, which provides wool and silk and cotton to weavers. The statistics show there are 10 million rural and nomadic women who contribute to agricultural production in the country. That's around 49% of the entire rural community. And cooperatives help protect the hard-earned income of women as well.
Despite Iran's rich history of producing handmade rugs, the tribal rugs produced in rural villages could be under threat from a lack of young weaving talent. So cooperatives play a big role in reviving and sustaining this ancient tradition. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers, who frequently receive the least amount of profits from their products. This is mainly because there are a lot of middlemen who make money from carpets. With that in mind, cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the chain of production by linking producers of material with weavers and weavers with buyers, which completes a production cycle. There are many opportunities for investment in the field of carpet weaving, especially in the field of dyeing, spinning, and livestock. Millions of Iranians are directly employed in rug making, and many more indirectly. Also, there are numerous export markets available. It might be interesting to know that one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets is the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, due to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find other indirect avenues to purchase the highly coveted carpets, which reduced the profits returning to the country.
Now, hand-woven carpets typically get center stage in the textile industry. But Iran also makes large quantities of machine-made carpets with very high quality. Iran's carpet industry has maintained the integrity of its products while adjusting to modern demands. There are thousands of designs to choose from for nearly all purposes. And Iran also exports its carpets in large quantities.
Iran is one of the top 10 global exporters of machine-made carpets. The major exporters are China, Turkey, India, and Belgium. That's all according to the Ministry of Industry. Based on the same figures, Iran has a potential capacity to produce over 120 million square meters of machine-woven carpets, with some 1,300 production units nationwide. Innovation in production has been one of the pillars of speed. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran exported around $110 million worth of machine-made carpets in the first 6 months of this year. So far, carpets have been sent to 54 destination markets around the world. Industry participants say exports could have been higher last year if it wasn't for border closures due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Iran also exports hand-woven carpets. In fact, the statistics from the Customs Administration shows there was a 14% increase since last year. Exports of these items have generated well over $82 million in hard currency in the first quarter of this year. The government has plans to increase its exports through promoting online sales as well as pursuing Chinese markets. Around 3.5 million square meters of handmade carpet are woven in the country each year. That's according to Iran's National Carpet Center. Roughly 80% of carpets produced domestically are exported.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy. Have you ever purchased a piece of land on Mars? In the so-called metaverse, you can do that. Metaverse is a subcategory of the blockchain technology, where you can practically live in an entirely virtual world. Today, I'll walk you through an Iranian company that has a lot to say in the blockchain industry.
Artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, and blockchain. These are the keywords to unlocking a whole new world called Metaverse, where giant tech brands like Facebook have expressed huge interest in. But perhaps blockchain is the top layer in the new universe. EchoChain is one of a myriad of companies that are working to advance the blockchain technology and its amazing subcategory that's called cryptocurrency.
To step into the blockchain business, you'll need to learn the ABC of the market. Without it, you'd most probably face some serious challenges. But don't worry, this company is here to teach you the A to Z of the market.
When talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin is what comes in mind. But a large number of new names other than Bitcoin and Ethereum are emerging on a daily basis. To enter this business, you'll need to attend special courses to analyze the trends of different cryptos. And EchoChain has it all.
One of the major projects undertaken by this company was to create crypto trading bots that can help you buy and sell cryptocurrencies at the right time and with peace of mind.
As humans, we get tired. As humans, we go through emotional burdens, which could overcome our reasoning and lead to an irreparable loss in the hard-to-sketch crypto trends. Using EchoChain program bots, there's no need to fret about our human deficiencies. The Iranian tech company says it seeks to experience all areas of the blockchain technology. It believes if tapped into, the emerging tech can serve human beings to a great extent and make our lives easier. In fact, the blockchain tech was invented to give rise to the best known crypto, Bitcoin. But today, its applications go beyond digital currencies. This Iranian company says a blockchain stores information electronically in digital format. It can be in the form of games, virtual reality, and augmented reality, or any new wild idea, such as metaverse.
The blockchain technology is revolutionizing the way we live, as it easily combines with other high-tech areas, such as IoT, to give rise to new, more complex technologies. In this burgeoning market, in order to survive, companies will need to be innovative and keep tabs on the latest developments. This company says it's already on track. Well, many thanks for that awesome report. With that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, thank you. Stay safe.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, presents. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And yeah, we see the presence. Talking about presence, well, presence in the sense of also something very beautiful and quite important in Islam. We are told that it's one very nice way of sort of strengthening our ties with our fellow believers, and whether it's with family members or whether it's with friends, work colleagues, or even neighbors. So this is something that is definitely very beneficial. And obviously when we get presents for people, and the presents do not necessarily have to have been things that we bought. It's always been the case that we can also sort of make presents. For example, we could choose to bake bake a cake or bake something or prepare a beautiful meal for someone, to give it to another family, to give it to our neighbors. These are also presents, all that counts. Obviously, the other thing with buying presents for people is it also shows that, yeah, obviously, we have one trait, and that, well, obviously, we're thinking about other people, so we're sort of kind towards others, we're aware of their needs, but also it's being generous, basically. It's sort of a sense of sort of also our charity towards others by giving, whether we're sort of donating things or whether we're giving presents to people, it's all giving. And it's all very beautiful. So I just want to mention something that one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Fence did, by the name of Ibrahim Hadi. So he was always looking after his friends. And at one point, he bought a large number of shoes. I think these were sort of they were described as sort of walking boots or shoes, or just very sort of sturdy and useful shoes. And he was going to take all of these shoes with him to the front to give to us of his fellow fighters there, basically, to help them out. Welcome back to AIDS here on iBinks Radio, me Sister Zaina. I'm talking about the idea that obviously we give presents, and I've just mentioned that the famous martyr from Home Defence, Ibrahim Hadi, for example, had bought lots of shoes for his fellow soldiers at the front, because obviously you can imagine having useful, robust and comfortable shoes at the front is very important. So yeah, this is, and obviously this is something that is very useful. Look, and when we get presents for other people, so whether it's just because we were passing a shop and we randomly remember that, oh, maybe my husband or my wife or my child or my friend likes things like this, and we just go in and get something because we've seen something that they really love. And so no matter what, obviously it depends on financial situation. It doesn't even have to be expensive anyway. But that just shows that we're listening to the people around us, especially those who are close to us. We know their needs, we know what they like, and so they're in our mind, which is something very good. And obviously that then extends. So this is not, so then, for example, so it's not just randomly, so just ad hoc, just in the spur of the moment, basically, thinking, oh, they'd like this, let's get this for our friend, or whoever it is. But also, for example, if we've gone on a trip, if we've been traveling, especially if we've been, for example, away from our local town, if the people have also been to other cities or even other countries, it's lovely to bring things back. And obviously people really enjoy little souvenirs or little presents from other places. And it's not always so much about what it is that we bring back. It's also about the fact that, well, that person went away and they still thought of us. They still had us in their mind. So, you know, I pray that this is, if we haven't done this ourselves, if we maybe go away and we, you know, we don't have those thoughts in our mind, well, maybe even if we just do it once, because obviously remember, if we do something like that once and then maybe even a few more times, gradually we could establish a habit of, you know, just considering some of the people around us and bringing things for them. So let's have the habit of getting presents, of making presents for people around us, inshallah. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AIDS Ed here on I'm Being Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. Everything mentioned so far serves merely as an example of the manifestations, outcomes, and some consequences of direct American hegemony over Iraq since the military invasion in 2003, particularly in the economic, financial, and oil sectors. Having examined the background and causes of this domination, we will now delve into the origins of comprehensive American hegemony over Iraq and its roots. For over a century, although the occupiers of our lands have changed and the slogans and justifications for occupation and invasion have evolved, the fundamental goal remains unchanged: to dominate our territories, their resources, and the Arab world. This reality is not exclusive to Iraq, but extends throughout the entire region, from British and French colonialism after World War I to American hegemony in both its old and modern forms. The American hegemony in Iraq is an extension of colonial history. The U.S. intervention did not start with the 2003 invasion or the sanctions imposed in 1990. The true American hegemony has lasted for over 70 years. Although it was not exhaustive or complete at the beginning, it specifically began with the precursors to the establishment of the Baghdad Pact in 1955. Even though the United States was not a partner in the pact, it did support it. This agreement was established under the pretext of confronting communist movements and Arab nationalism led by Egypt under the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser. If we look further back, even before the Baghdad Pact, we can assert that the strategy of American hegemony has been deeply entrenched. Even Noam Chomsky, in an article titled Modern American Imperialism, the Middle East and Beyond, published on April 24, 2008, traces the history of American hegemony back to before the Spanish-American War of 1898, suggesting that the United States is inherently a hegemonic power, as we discussed in previous episodes, most recent one being on November 28, 2025, titled The United States in Our Lands, Neither to Defend Israel Nor to Confront Iran. Looking back a bit in history to analyze the roots of the global hegemony that led to the domination of Iraq, imperialism began its transformation from its classical form in the 19th century, shifting from traditional military occupation to a global system of economic and political dominance. At the start of this transformation, powers like Germany, Japan, and the United States emerged to compete with Great Britain and other European nations for influence. Europe was thrust into a frantic race for the division of Africa and the control of markets and finances. These factors, along with others, led to the outbreak of World War I. After this war, the Treaty of Versailles marked a second phase of imperialism aimed at dividing the spoils and confronting communism. However, this project was interrupted by the Great Depression, which began with the collapse of the U.S. stock market in 1929 and World War II. With the conclusion of World War II, the leadership of colonial powers shifted from Great Britain to the United States. The United States later developed the Greater Middle East Initiative, a plan aimed at ensuring complete control over the strategic centers of the global economy under the guise of openness and free trade. This shift in leadership saw American imperialism take on new forms, such as international financial institutions, the monetary system, military alliances, and indirect interventions. Control over nations began to be exercised under the pretense of global order, no longer labeled as occupation. Focusing specifically on Iraq, following the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, Britain discovered a geographical and economic treasure. It occupied Iraq in 1917 and established a mandate system endorsed by the League of Nations. However, the truth is that this mandate was nothing more than a form of real colonialism disguised as a diplomatic document with a dedication signed by the League of Nations. London solidified its control over Iraqi oil through the Iraq Petroleum Company, shaping the modern state's map to serve its strategic interests. This design involved imposing a foreign king, Faisal I, and establishing an army primarily tasked with protecting the British crown rather than ensuring the safety of the Iraqi people. Despite popular uprisings in Iraq, particularly the 1920 revolution, Britain maintained its grip through political treaties, economic dominance, military presence, and infiltration of the ruling elites. In this way, Iraq emerged as a nominally independent and sovereign state, but in practice, it was subordinate to the British crown. After the conclusion of World War II, Washington stepped onto the stage, taking advantage of the decline of the British Empire and the rise of the United States as a global power. Iraq became a crucial piece in the conflict between East and West. The United States supported the Baghdad Pact in 1955, seemingly to contain the Soviet Union, and attempted to infiltrate the Iraqi army and administration. It employed political and media tools to undermine any nationalist projects that threatened its interests, particularly in the oil sector. With the 1958 revolution and the fall of the monarchy, it seemed that Iraq was beginning to break free from its colonial legacy. Despite its shift towards Arab nationalism or its adoption of this under the leadership of Abdel Karim Qasim and later the Ba'ath Party, Iraq remained a constant testing ground for American influence. This was exerted through conditional aid, intelligence agencies, and even through the manipulation of the head of state himself, such as Saddam, whom Washington used in the 1980s as a tool against Iran before he became a target to eliminate. Since the mid-20th century, the United States' policy towards Iraq has had a consistent goal to keep the country within its regional and global interests and to prevent Iraq from becoming an independent state that could pose a potential threat to those interests. The methods used have been diverse, ranging from covert interventions to economic pressures, military dominance, and control over institutions. Nevertheless, the ultimate aim has always remained the same, to ensure U.S. access to vital resources, especially oil, and to keep Iraq within the sphere of American influence. The initial tools of hegemony were intelligence and covert intervention. In the 1950s and 1960s, there were signs of U.S. support for elements and factions within the Iraqi army and for political movements capable of shifting the internal balance of power when necessary. We recall here the U.S. role in the Ba'ath Party coup and its rise to power in 1963. Another tool, both then and now, is tactical and economic support for regimes or leaders with whom collaboration can be established to achieve U.S. interests. For instance, in the 1980s, with the outbreak of Saddam's war against Iran, the United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Iraq. The United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Baghdad, providing intelligence data, indirect support, and at times direct assistance to Saddam's regime. If covert influence or alliances failed, Washington would turn to economic power, international pressure, and even military force. Following Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, an international military campaign led by the United States was launched under the banner of liberating Kuwait. Although the stated goal was to free an independent state, the real aim was to control another country and ultimately establish a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf while securing its oil. Washington led a massive coalition and enforced a suffocating embargo on Iraq for 13 years. This embargo devastated the infrastructure, weakened society, and paved the way for a phase of total domination. Programs like Oil for Food illustrated how international restrictions limited and fragmented the Iraqi state's ability to manage the resources of the Iraqi people. In 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq became the most perilous step due to the negative consequences for Iraq, its people, and the entire region. The project to strangle and control Iraq was based on the falsehood of spreading democracy and misleading claims of weapons of mass destruction. The American forces burst into Iraq to overthrow the regime and the Iraqi state within weeks. The Iraqi army was disbanded, institutions were dismantled, and the doors were wide open to sectarianism, corruption, and the systematic plundering of wealth. In reality, the American occupation of Iraq was the culmination of a century of colonial policies. Among the strategies employed by Washington was political control through a quota system that ensured the division and fragmentation of the elite, thereby preventing the establishment of an Iraqi state modeled after a unified national state. Secondly, economic dominance is achieved through the privatization of a significant portion of the public sector and the connection of Iraq to international financial institutions. This results in the Iraqi economy becoming reliant on debt and imports. Thirdly, military and security influence is achieved through the training and equipping of the army and security forces, the establishment of permanent military bases, and the signing of strategic partnership agreements. Fourthly, cultural and media penetration is achieved through the promotion of the liberal democracy model based on American standards, along with support from media networks and civil society organizations that are funded to sway public opinion. In fifth place, the management of natural resources is carried out, particularly regarding oil, through long-term contracts that ensure the ongoing control of Western companies over every production and marketing. In sixth place, support is provided to sectarian, regional, tribal, or clan parties and leaders with the aim of fragmenting the political landscape and limiting the space for inclusive national action. In seventh place, international institutions, particularly the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, WB, are used to dictate the terms of reconstruction and debt, imposing structural economic reforms that undermine the Iraqi state's ability to make independent decisions. As noted, the American plan and methods for domination over Iraq are an extension of the country's colonial history. Furthermore, they are a crucial part of the Greater Middle East Project, a long-term strategic vision that the United States began to articulate after the Cold War and which solidified following the events of September 11, 2001. The aim of this project is to reshape the political, economic, and social geography of the countries in the region, which stretches from Morocco to Pakistan. This initiative has ancient roots and was developed by a group of American diplomats, economists, and thinkers. The initial outlines emerged in the 1990s with the New World Order speech delivered by George H.W. Bush following the collapse of the Soviet Union. This plan evolved into an official project under the leadership of George W. Bush in 2004, which was formalized as the Greater Middle East and North Africa Initiative. The stated goal was to promote democracy and political and economic reforms in the Arab and Islamic world, but the underlying aim was to reshape the map of influence and borders to benefit U.S. hegemony. Additionally, the aim was to connect the target countries to a unified network of economic and security interests, naturally led by Washington, so that this vast region could become an alternative sphere of U.S. strategic influence to ensure its global dominance against China. This project also has implicit goals, particularly the dismantling of major central states like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Egypt, and Iran into smaller sectarian or ethnic entities to facilitate their control. Additionally, there is a constant goal of ensuring Israel's security by dismantling the powerful neighboring states and transforming the Arab-Israeli conflict from an existential liberation struggle against the colonial power into a mere cultural and developmental issue. This, of course, secures Israel's safety as the primary tool of hegemony over the countries in the region. Thirdly, another implicit goal is to manage energy resources, oil and gas, through subordinate regimes or Western companies. It's important to note that this objective is openly discussed by thinkers, researchers, and some U.S. officials. Fourthly, it's essential to contain China, Russia, and Iran, preventing any Asian-Eurasian axis from competing with Washington in the strategic waterways of the Persian Gulf, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Suez Canal, and the Mediterranean. Fifthly, one of the key objectives is also to re-engineer the political and social culture within Arab societies through media, education, and civil organizations. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, this war has been more than just a territorial or regime struggle. It's been a battle over the very meaning of sovereignty. Iraq was not only invaded by armies, but also by ideas, promises, debts, and structures specifically designed to hinder its recovery. The occupation marked the beginning of a new phase and a different form of American hegemony, where military control evolved into a continuous system renewed through various tools, including military bases, oil contracts, financial influence, and a democracy directed and managed from abroad. Prominent American thinkers point out military force alone does not create legitimacy, and imposing control does not equate to achieving stability. The Iraq that Washington aimed to subjugate is the same Iraq that revealed the fragility of its imperial project when the invasion turned into a strategic burden. However, empires do not easily surrender and always replace their tools with new ones that allow them to maintain their overall dominance, albeit in different ways than before. Today, more than two decades after the fall of Baghdad, the most pressing question remains: has Iraq truly freed itself from occupation, or has its captivity merely been reconfigured within a global system that denies it full sovereignty? The answer is not straightforward. The United States will not allow Iraq to easily respond to this question through complete liberation and genuine independence without resistance. However, it is true that the journey towards true independence is not solely measured by the withdrawal of armies, but by the ability of people to break the chains of hegemony, whether they are visible or hidden. I'll see you next week, inshallah, for a new episode.
Searching for the light.